That's Bill Jennings on guitar and Jack McDuff on organ, one of my favorite musicians, with Blues Jams. It's from their collaborative effort and their 1959 album, Enough Said. Wendell Marshall on bass and Bill Elliott on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and Brother Obama gets schooled on U.S.-Cuba history. In fact, he gets old-schooled by former President Fidel Castro in an essay penned by Castro and appearing in yesterday's Granma, that's the official organ of Cuba, titled Brother Obama. President Obama apparently came in for some history lessons. I urge you to get a copy of the text, but I will share with you what it says. I'm reading, of course, the English translation. I didn't see the original Spanish translation, a Spanish transcript, I should say. But I'll share with you what the English translation said. Brother Obama, and this is the intro to the piece, we don't need the empire to give us anything. Our efforts will be legal and peaceful because our commitment is to peace and fraternity among all human beings who live on this planet. The piece is titled Brother Obama. It begins, the kings of Spain brought us the conquistadors and masters whose footprints remained in the circular land grants assigned to those searching for gold in the sands of rivers, an abusive and shameful form of exploitation, traces of which can be noted from the air in many places around the country. Tourism today, in large part, consists of viewing the delights of our landscapes and tasting exquisite delicacies from our seas, and is always shared with the private capital of large foreign corporations whose earnings, if they don't reach billions of dollars, are not worthy of any attention whatsoever. Since I find myself obliged to mention the issue, I must add, principally for the youth, that few people are aware of the importance of such a condition in this singular moment of human history. I would not say that time has been lost, but I do not hesitate to affirm that we are not adequately informed, not you nor us, of the knowledge and conscience that we must have to confront the realities which challenge us. The first to be taken into consideration is that our lives are but a fraction of a historical second, which must also be devoted in part to the vital necessities of every human being. One of the characteristics of this condition is the tendency to overvalue its role. In contrast, on the other hand, with the extraordinary number of persons who embody the loftiest dreams. Nevertheless, no one is good or bad entirely on their own. None of us is designed for the role we must assume in a revolutionary society, although Cubans had the privilege of José Martí's example. I even ask myself if he needed to die or not in Dos Ríos when he said, "For me, it's time," and charged the Spanish forces entrenched in a solid line of firepower. He did not want to return to the United States, and there was no one who could make him. Someone ripped some pages from his diary. Who bears this treacherous responsibility? Undoubtedly the work of an unscrupulous conspirator. Differences between the leaders were well known, but never in discipline. Quote, "Whoever attempts to appropriate Cuba will reap only the dust of its soil drenched in blood if he does not perish in the struggle," unquote, stated the glorious black leader Antonio Maceo. Maximo Gomez is likewise, hold on for a minute, I just lost my page. Oh boy, okay, I'm going to relocate it. Sorry about that. Maximo Gomez is likewise recognized as the most disciplined and discreet military chief in our history. Looking at it from another angle, how can we not admire the indignation of Bonifacio Byrne when, from a distant boat returning him to Cuba, he saw another flag alongside that of the single star and declared, "My flag is that which has never been mercenary," immediately adding one of the most beautiful phrases I have ever heard, "If it is torn to shreds, it will be my flag one day. Our dead raising their arms will still be able to defend it." Nor will I forget the blistering words of Camilo Cienfuegos that night when just some tens of meters away, bazookas and machine guns of U.S. origin in the hands of counter-revolutionaries were pointed toward that terrace on which he stood. Obama was born in August of 1961, as he himself explained. More than half a century has transpired since that time. Let us see, however, how our illustrious guest thinks today. Quote, "I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I've come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people," unquote. Followed by a deluge of concepts entirely novel for the majority of us. Quote, "We both live in a new world, colonized by Europeans," unquote, the U.S. president continued. Quote, "Cuba, like the United States, was built in part by slaves brought here from Africa. Like the United States, the Cuban people can trace their heritage to both slaves and slave owners," unquote. The native populations don't exist at all in Obama's mind, nor does he say that the revolution swept away racial discrimination or that pensions and salaries for all Cubans were decreed by it before Mr. Barack Obama was 10 years old. The hateful, racist bourgeois custom of hiring strong men to expel black citizens from recreational centers was swept away by the Cuban Revolution, that which would go down in history for the battle against apartheid that liberated Angola, putting an end to the presence of nuclear weapons on a continent of more than a billion inhabitants. This was not the objective of our solidarity, but rather to help the peoples of Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, and others under the fascist colonial domination of Portugal. In 1961, just 1 year and 3 months after the triumph of the revolution, a mercenary force with armored artillery and infantry, backed by aircraft, trained and accompanied by U.S. warships and aircraft carriers, attacked our country by surprise. Nothing can justify that perfidious attack, which cost our country hundreds of losses, including deaths and injuries. As for the pro-Yankee assault brigade, no evidence exists anywhere that it was possible to evacuate a single mercenary. Yankee combat planes were presented before the United Nations as the equipment of a Cuban uprising. The military experience and power of this country is very well known. In Africa, they likewise believed that revolutionary Cuba would be easily taken out of the fight. The invasion via southern Angola by racist South African motorized brigades got close to Luanda, the capital in the eastern part of the country. There, a struggle began which went on for no less than 15 years. I wouldn't even talk about this if I didn't have the elemental duty to respond to Obama's speech in Havana's Alicia Alonso Grand Theater. Nor will I attempt to give details, only emphasize that an honorable chapter in the struggle for human liberation was written there. In a certain way, I hoped Obama's behavior would be correct. His humble origin and natural intelligence were evident. Mandela was imprisoned for life and had become a giant in the struggle for human dignity. One day, a copy of a book narrating part of Mandela's life reached my hands. And surprise, the prologue was by Barack Obama. I rapidly skimmed the pages. The minuscule size of Mandela's handwriting, noting facts, was incredible. Knowing men such as him was worthwhile. Regarding the episode in South Africa, I must point out another experience. I was really interested in learning more about how the South Africans had acquired nuclear weapons. I only had very precise information that there were no more than 10 or 12 bombs. A reliable source was the professor and researcher Piero Gleyesis, who had written the text, Conflicting Missions, Havana, Washington, and Africa, 1959 to 1976, an excellent piece. I knew he was the most reliable source on what had happened, and I told him so. He responded that he had not spoken more about the matter, as in the text he had responded to questions from Compañero Jorge Risquet, who had been Cuban ambassador and collaborator in Angola, a very good friend of his. I located Risquet, already undertaking other important tasks. He was finishing a course which would last several weeks longer. That task coincided with a fairly recent visit by Piero to our country. I had warned him that Risquet was getting on and his health was not great. A few days later, what I had feared occurred. Risquet deteriorated and died. When Piero arrived, there was nothing to do except make promises. But I had already received information related to the weapons and the assistance that the racist South Africa had received from Reagan and Israel. I do not know what Obama would have to say about this story now. I'm unaware as to what he did or did not know, although it is very likely that he knew absolutely nothing. My modest suggestion is that he gives it thought and does not attempt now to elaborate theories on Cuban policy. There is an important issue. Obama made a speech in which he uses the most sweetened words to express, quote, "It is time now to forget the past, leave the past behind, let us look to the future, a future of hope. And it won't be easy. There will be challenges and we must give it time. But my stay here gives me more hope in what we can do together as friends, as family, as neighbors together," unquote. I suppose all of us were at risk of a heart attack upon hearing these words from the President of the United States. After a ruthless blockade that has lasted almost 60 years, and what about those who have died in the mercenary attacks on Cuban ships and ports, an airliner full of passengers blown up in midair, mercenary invasions, multiple acts of violence and coercion? Nobody should be under the illusion that the people of this dignified and selfless country will renounce the glory, the rights, or the spiritual wealth they have gained with the development of education, science, and culture. I also warn that we are capable of producing the food and material riches we need with the efforts and intelligence of our people. We do not need the empire to give us anything. Our efforts will be legal and peaceful, as this is our commitment to peace and fraternity among all human beings who live on this planet. Fidel Castro Ruz, March 27, 2016, 10:25 p.m. And that was the missive written by former President Fidel Castro addressing Brother Obama, evidently saying that the president could use a lesson or two about U.S. Cuba history. We talked about that here. Gerald Horn talked about that as well. And you, the listeners, have talked about the various faux pas, omissions, commissions, diplomatic slides that the president committed while in Cuba on a historic trip to follow up his intention to reestablish bilateral ties with the Cuban government and people. And we talked about the tone, we talked about glaring omissions in history, and we talked about that paternalistic attitude and a simplistic interpretation of history and the message, again, that, oh yeah, we're doing you a great favor, we're going to bring democracy finally to you, something you know nothing about and something we're expert at, and we're bringing all of that to you. And we should now just, you know, set aside the past. It's over. It's done with. Let's get on with it. You know, the same thing people say about slavery in the United States. Just, you know, that's over now. Get on with life. Just move on with life. Get on with it. But what do you think about President Castro's essay, his letter to Brother Obama? Do you think President Obama appreciates what is in that message, and what do you glean from it? What is it? What is the symbolism and significance of that letter, of that essay? 888-874-4888. And then we move on to our second segment right after that. I really think there are times when we miss the symbolism and significance of a moment. And of course, you know, we are encouraged by a compliant media to think of it as just, you know, it's about a speech. But as we discuss here on the program all the time, before you even hear a speech or read a speech, you want to appreciate the context of it. And it therefore becomes extremely meaningful when taken in its totality. Here is the President of the United States. Of course, he's on his way out. He's completing his final year in office. And he is wrapping things up. And all of these are little pieces. They're pieces of his legacy, if you will, as President of the United States. This rapprochement with Cuba would be a major accomplishment in historical terms. He goes to Cuba, presumably to seal the deal. Of course, we still know that it is not final. Congress still has to approve of it. The embargo still is in effect. It has not yet been lifted. And other things have to happen legislatively to actually establish and finalize any ties with Cuba. But we were talking about how statespeople conduct themselves. They are, of course, representing the country and presumably the sentiments of the people. And one would have imagined that at a time like that, when the President of the United States is addressing the people of Cuba and the government of Cuba, you would imagine that with respect to the mission, which is to indicate a need to look to the future, you would imagine that at least he would account for some of the horrific past inflicted upon the same country by the United States. And I understand it may be uncomfortable to do it, but we certainly cannot just overlook how patronizing the president was and how wrong-headed his historical accounts were. This speech was written by a clear historical novice or somebody intentionally ignorant of history. Ma'at, you're on the air. What do you think of the content of President Castro's speech, of his essay, I should say?
Am I on the air now?
Yes.
Hotep to the beloved family and to you, Utresa. Everybody stay well. I thank you for sharing that. I can't wait to print that out in English, of course. And I have one of my thoughts is it was just so, this is the idea of peace with all humanity. I think I heard that twice. And that is so key because really nobody has a future until all the war making and the terror making and the false flag making, until that stops. I think the history is so key in that, in certain terms, he brings us back to the inevitable, and that is European neo-colonial patriarchal white supremacy. You know, it's like we can't move from there. That's what moves the world and the agenda. So I thought it was quite sobering. And what is Castro? What is do you know his age now, Utrice?
He is in his 80s. I don't know his precise age.
Yeah, late 80s or early 90s now. But I found it profound. And it also said, thank you, but no thank you, in terms of your continuing history. And I thought it was very powerful, and I'll hear what my other brothers and sisters have to say. Thank you.
Thank you so much. 888-874-4888. It was extraordinarily significant, but I'll hear from you what you thought. Henry from Chicago.
Hey, Truth, how's it going?
Good. Thank you. What was significant about this essay to you?
I mean, you know, the thing about it was, you know, you understand the depth of Castro, Fidel Castro's knowledge of history and how he explains it, you know, on a depth where Obama never even touched. And I don't think it's I don't think the fact that whoever wrote Obama's speech didn't know history. They just didn't want to include the relevant history of, you know, of Cuba and the relations with the United States. But this is one of the reasons why Castro was so hard to overrun, or, you know, a lot of his people and a lot of his followers did not want to, you know, quote unquote, overthrow him, because when he took over the country, he politically educated them. And this sounds like one of those political educations that he's telling, you know, not only his people, but, you know, the United States, who are interested in true relations with, you know, Cuba, but, you know, not in the sense of where Obama and the government and businesses, you know, want to basically come in and just take over Cuba. So, you know, you admire the perception, the depth, and the willingness to share the real relevance of Cuban history to the people, you know, despite the fact that, you know, Obama, who, you know, basically tried to come in and use Cuban history, you know, to, you know, to his advantage.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. You know, what is interesting to me was the citing of the people who played critical roles in defending Cuba against various imperial armies. But he first cites Antonio Maceo, an African in Cuba, who is the father of the Cuban Revolution. He cites Máximo Gómez. He cites Bonifacio Byrne. And essentially what he is saying in very diplomatic language is that it was a multicultural defense, right? Cuba is not just being defended on the basis of class, but also is defended by a full range of racial groups, beginning with the native people of Cuba. And this was one of the things we talked about. The president of the United States, as far as his history goes, is saying, well, you know, Cuba's history goes back to slavery. No, not at all. He completely wipes out all of that prior history relating to the genocide, the absolute genocide of the indigenous population all through the Caribbean. My friend, the late Dr. Jan Carew, his book Rape of Paradise, goes back to the Columbian era and notes that within a matter of decades, within two decades of Columbus's arrival in the Caribbean, the entire population of the Caribbean was decimated, absolutely decimated. So when the president of the United States decides to publicly engage in historical revisionism, it is so embarrassing. Ali from New York, what do you think about what we shared today?
Okay, hi, Idris. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, I just wanted to make a point that one of the things that he said on that letter is that if you take a look at what happened with the revolution, people that look like you, Cuban, black Cuban, will still be almost like a slave because the situation was so bad. And that's what I think one of the things that he emphasizing, that he doesn't take in account that some, yes, they still have racism in Cuba, but it's not at the level that black people in Cuba are not able to do things for themselves. As a matter of fact, last year I went to Bolivia, and I saw one of those hospitals where Cuban doctors are volunteering. And I actually, who did I see? Two black Cuban doctors in Bolivia, in a very small town. So this is something that I don't think Obama has been able to understand. Maybe because he doesn't, maybe he doesn't consider himself as a black man or an African-American man. But that's one thing that I think he emphasized, because he's he brings out how black people have been able to better themselves in Cuba because of their revolution. And that is a very, very big thing. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we'll take a break and come back and talk about Sister Hillary and the U.S. Supreme Court. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. Hillary Clinton is warning voters about a pending disaster, she says. What is this pending disaster? If Donald Trump gets to name an appointee to the U.S. Supreme Court, it's absolute disaster. And, of course, disaster could be averted if, of course, the nation has the sense to elect her. Well, you know, it's interesting about this nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. As you know, the president has his person in mind, Garland Merrick, to replace the late Antonin Scalia. And the Republicans, of course, have threatened by no means are they going to permit a hearing on this appointment, and they will block it. Well, Hillary Clinton says absolutely not. They shouldn't block it. They should go ahead. And if they succeed, if the Republicans succeed, i.e. Donald Trump, because he is the front runner currently, as supposedly she is, then Donald Trump will get to name the U.S. Supreme Court justice. And this should not happen. Absolutely not. She's dead set against the Republicans taking this action. Well, I found a little something that seems to suggest that this is for Hillary herself a change of heart. Here she is in a speech that she made in 2005. This is before the Democratic National Committee's Women's Leadership Forum in 2005. Talking. And then I want to play first, though, a statement she made just March the 6th, talking in this so-called debate with Bernie Sanders on the issue of the U.S. Supreme Court nomination process. And she apparently is of two minds. Take a listen.
That is one of the many reasons we must all support President Obama's right to nominate a successor to Justice Scalia and demand that the Senate hold hearings and a vote on that successor.
I believe this is one of the most important roles that the Senate plays. This, after all, is in the Constitution. We are asked to give advice and consent or to deny advice and consent.
And that...
So basically, when she was a senator, it was all right to block the nomination process when she was a senator. But now that she is running for president, it is not all right to block President Obama's nominee. You know, politics makes you, you know, develop this kind of a two-faced approach to life. But the reason I bring this up is that people are, of course, going to be encouraged to focus on the U.S. Supreme Court as being the big issue, as one of the issues in this presidential race. Oh, the president will, the next president will be naming a justice to the U.S. Supreme Court. Oh my God, what an incredibly important thing. And this should be the basis of your vote. You ought to vote. Because the president is going to name the next U.S. Supreme Court justice. Here's what I say. Don't let it bother you. Don't let the U.S. Supreme Court bother you or whoever else should be appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. It really shouldn't bother you that much. And I'm assuming in saying this that you are part of the vast majority of people who basically have or should have a unique vantage point on the U.S. Supreme Court, which in my view is not at all supreme, except in its retrograde, mostly retrograde decisions. The U.S. Supreme Court, I mean, just what is the U.S. Supreme Court supposed to be doing? It's supposed to be that grouping that interprets the law. And people actually believe it's supreme in the sense of its infallibility. It can't make a mistake. It is always wise. It always does the right thing. It always comes to the right conclusion. It is just. No, it's not. The U.S. Supreme Court has a rotten history of making the worst decisions on the planet, depending on where you stand in the society. If you're an African-American, Latino, an Asian, any member of a so-called minority group, you shouldn't be too concerned about the U.S. Supreme Court at all. But if you are corporate, if you are very, very wealthy, yeah, I guess it would concern you. Because then the U.S. Supreme Court will be making decisions that affect mostly your pocketbook. Here's what we really need to worry about. Worry about what's happening, not at the U.S. Supreme Court level, but worry about what's going on in the lower courts. That's where the genocide is occurring. That's where the big problems are. That's where the nation is producing in excess of 2 million people. Worry about that. And you will not find the presidential candidates as a group addressing that issue. Nor would you find Hillary Clinton addressing that issue because, frankly, she cannot. It would be too embarrassing. The slaughter is occurring, especially to people of color in this country, in the lower courts. The U.S. Supreme Court would probably get about a couple of thousand cases every year, every term. The website says it handles or it gets about 7,000 to 8,000 cases every term, of which less than 1% will be actually reviewed by the court. So on a numerical basis, the court doesn't handle very much traffic. So statistically, we don't have the U.S. Supreme Court making devastating decisions that affect in a major way people's daily lives. That's happening at the lower courts. The lower courts are where we're getting done in. Supreme Court, state courts, housing court, criminal court. These are the courts that are really, really out of order. Now, how does Hillary Clinton connect to all of this? You see, Brother Bill, her co-president of the United States, is in large part responsible for producing the slaughter in the lower court system. By the time a case gets to the U.S. Supreme Court, it has gone through a whole bunch of permutations at the lower level. And, you know, it may, and it's a rare thing that it would go directly to the U.S. Supreme Court unless it's brought by the state as a state issue and it goes directly there, or some major case, but it would take some time. What is happening every day in this country is that the lower courts are part of a genocidal attack on people of color in this country. Currently, more than 2.2 million people are incarcerated in the United States, produced in the lower courts. The United States has the largest prison population in the world. 5% of the world's population, but 25% and growing of its prison population. How does that happen? Well, you can look to Bill Clinton's concept of triangulation. Yes, triangulation. First, you build more prisons because, of course, you need to put this population, you know, the ones that Hillary called the super predators. You got to put them away. You build more prisons. That's one part of the triangle. And then you put them behind bars. You make sure that they go to jail. That was the three strikes law that Bill Clinton inaugurated. So you put them in jail. You make sure they go. And the third part, you make sure that they stay there longer than they need to. That's right. Bill Clinton and co-president Hillary Clinton gave us triangulation. The whole concept of building an entire, the prison industrial complex, that's them. Yeah, it began a little sooner, Reagan and his drug laws, but it was Bill Clinton who gave us the laws that Sister Hillary was proud to say would cure the United States of its super predator problem. I'm going to read you an excerpt of an article I found from 2015, written by Ed Pilkington for The Guardian. He says, former President Bill Clinton has called for an end to mass incarceration, admitting that changes in penal policy that happened largely under his watch put, quote, too many people in prison and for too long, unquote, and, quote, overshot the mark, unquote. During Clinton's 8 years in the White House, the incarceration figures saw some of their steepest rises in modern times, though the numbers had already begun to shoot up under Ronald Reagan's vaunted war on drugs in the 1980s, Clinton further inflated them. When he won his first presidential election in 1992, there were 847,000 people in prison. By the time he ended his second term in 2000, that population had grown to 1,334,000. So Bill Clinton specialized his administration through this triangulation, rewarding states, giving federal money to the states to build more prisons, to sentence these people needlessly people who didn't deserve to be in prison or didn't deserve to be sentenced, didn't get the advantage of alternatives, and then kept them there longer. Because after all, it was part of the U.S. economy. Prisons. So then he says, Clinton also introduced a program called COPS, Community-Oriented Policing Services, in which federal money was provided to states to allow them vastly to increase the number of police officers on the street, in turn generating more arrests and more convictions. Because you see, at that time, Clinton wanted to prove that even as a so-called liberal Democrat, he was tough on crime. Tough on crime. So when Hillary Clinton tells you that the problem is the U.S. Supreme Court, you must remember that it isn't the Supreme Court that's your problem. That was established back in the 1700s and 1800s. You know, there are several populations here that could tell you how foul the U.S. Supreme Court has been, how incapable it is of being just, and how partisan the U.S. Supreme Court has become. And there is no reason to trust that the U.S. Supreme Court actually will deliver justice. You can't trust that. If you want to review all these laws emanating from the so-called interpretation of the U.S. Constitution and the decisions made in terms of the U.S. Supreme Court rulings, and you want to tell me that you should still regard the U.S. Supreme Court as some kind of arbiter of justice, as some model of wisdom and justice, I'll tell you flat out, you're crazy. The U.S. Supreme Court is certainly not supreme at all, except in its foibles. It has made supreme foibles. If I recommend that you go through some of the reports and books that have been written about the lousy decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court. In fact, in this political season, we're dealing with one right now. Citizens United. That's a lousy decision. But it came from your U.S. Supreme Court. And therefore, it's the law of the land. That doesn't make it correct. It doesn't make it wise. It just makes it politic. So dispense any notion that when you talk about the U.S. Supreme Court, you ought to be quaking in your boots as to who the next U.S. Supreme Court justice will be. Don't worry about it. No matter who it is, no matter who names the person, you can still bet statistically that the U.S. Supreme Court will remain largely as is, both in terms of its interpretation of its role and in its decisions. Don't expect any dramatic changes there. But that is not the problem, really, because you could still say, I mean, you could reason it out. Statistically, the harm that's going to be done at the U.S. Supreme Court level pales in comparison to what's going on now in the lower courts. We have all these horrific stories, these horror stories. The legal genocide is being committed every day. A slaughter is committed every single day and directed mostly toward people of color and the poor and the lower classes. They're not getting justice at all in the courts. And it is people like Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton who are responsible. All well and good for her to stand up now and talk about who should have the right to nominate and how the process ought to go. I just played you the exact opinion. She expressed an exact opposite opinion when she was a senator. Oh, we should have the right to advise and to not advise, which is what the Republicans are saying. We have the right to advise and not advise. We choose not to advise. And she was defending that just in 2005. You can't trust these people. They're politicians. They'll say whatever they need to say. But you must make that connection. You can't just forget these kinds of connections. Don't tell me about the U.S. Supreme Court. That's not my trouble. Let's discuss the lower courts and your role in creating this genocidal attack. You and your husband. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about your role in creating the largest prison population on the planet. And where the people being targeted are mostly people of color. Let's talk about that. The Guardian piece that I read from to you reports in 2015 of Bill Clinton publicly making something of an act of contrition. He's standing up saying, oh, you know, perhaps, maybe it's possible that my policies put too many people in prison. That's what he said. And he has repeated that because he has been confronted on it. But he can afford, and so can Hillary now, afford to treat this as a kind of, you know, hypothetical issue. It's not so real as much as it is, you know, a policy review. Yes. Upon review, yes, it would appear that, you know, the policies, this triangulation, might have done in just a bit too many people. Yes, I think I made an error there. There is no connection at all between their abuse of power and the forfeiting of people's lives and freedom. There is no connection. There's no attempt at all to even deal with the reality. They are responsible. They are the ones who are responsible. And nobody's confronting her about that. You have these silly black elected officials and Latino elected officials whose populations are primarily the target of this, falling over themselves, trying to find ways to pronounce their support for Hillary Clinton for president. And it is their children, their husbands, their brothers, their mothers, their sisters, their daughters that are going to jail and remaining there, subjected to incredibly biased and prejudicial adjudication in the lower courts of law. So don't presume to educate me about how important it is that I should be concerned about the U.S. Supreme Court. It's not my problem. That was made clear with Dred Scott. The Dred Scott decision set for all time everything you need to know about the courts if you are a black person in this country. If you're a thinking person, it should set for all time what your attitude should be about the U.S. Supreme Court. I need no further education about the U.S. Supreme Court. The worst the acknowledged worst decision, but still it's being talked about as if it were merely an academic issue when it is alive and well, and it is the basis of how much of our society is run to this very day. So I don't need an education about the U.S. Supreme Court, and I couldn't care less about it. I know enough. We need to focus, and we need to make her absolutely claim, she and her husband, the co-president, make them understand that they, what they have done in this country with the use of the lower courts is tantamount to war crimes, crimes against humanity. You have 2.2 million people in this country locked up because you have the authority and power to enact rules and laws that would send them there. And once they're there, they're in a kind of oblivion. Nobody cares about them. And you can today talk about it as if it were just merely a policy lapse. All this to say, when Sister Hillary talks next about the U.S. Supreme Court and who should have the right to name who and whatnot, remind yourself that that's not the issue. And it shouldn't be your issue for a long, long time. What should concern us is her role and her husband's role in this crime against humanity that has produced the largest prison population on earth. The U.S. Supreme Court is not my concern. I thank you so much for joining me today and for allowing us to explore these two subjects together. I hope you glean something from it. And again, it's all part of the business of putting things together. It seems so disconnected, but they're really not. You have to put these things together. And when you do, you see how logical it all is. It all falls into place. The thing, though, is that we are encouraged always to see things as disconnected events. And they are not at all disconnected. What looks like a simple campaign issue is really the story of a huge chunk of America. A really awful story that has been going on for a long time. And there are people who are responsible and they get away with it because we don't demand that they account for the policies that they make. We give them a free pass. Thanks for joining me. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking and we'll see each other tomorrow. In the meantime, please know for me, it is a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.